drew stick figures. A table with a tiny boy under it, two smaller boys standing in the doorway to the kitchen, and Mom 5 times larger than anyone else. The fly swatter she held in her right hand was twice as large as me. I drew long wires in every direction for her hair. I hung the picture on the blackboard, and then I told the F-word story with my back to the group. Usually, it made people laugh. But when I turned around, 4 women had tears in their eyes. The other man in the group shook his head. "I thought that was funny," I said. "Look at the picture a little more closely," said the therapist. "What's the little boy doing under the table? He's hiding. It's more like he's cringing, isn't it? Why is he hiding from his mother? He's terrified. Look at your mother in proportion to you. You made her 5 times larger. What's that saying?" "Maybe it's impossible for the little boy to defend himself. Now tell us again, what's funny about that picture?" I couldn't respond. At this rehab center, they wouldn't allow me to heal myself by turning my beatings into acts of hilarity. The 6 of us in my therapy group were together for a reason. We were the products of traumatic childhoods with abusive mothers and passive fathers. For the next few days, I listened as members of my group struggled to draw connections between their upbringings and their adult dysfunctions. Everyone in the group could make those connections easily for other people. The therapist had forbidden any of us to give advice. She knew we had to discover the connections for ourselves in order to change, so she plied us with leading questions. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. "Everything we experience passes through a filter in our minds so we can make sense out of our lives," she said. "Sometimes that filter gets covered with crap in our childhood, and we grow up believing lies about ourselves and about other people. Sometimes our filters tell us lies that protect our destructive behavior. This week is about cleaning that filter." At the end of the week came the experiential, an exercise to release years of anger that have imprisoned our hearts. The day before, I wrote a letter to Mom, Dad, and Papa, my maternal grandfather, saying things to them that I'd never had the chance to say while they were alive. The therapist turned the lights off and closed the blinds. I sat at the end of the room with the window at my back. The therapist sat in front of me. The rest of the group sat against the wall to my left. The therapist told me to close my eyes and leave them closed for the duration of the session. "I want you to think of a pleasant time when you were 52, she said. Then she asked what I saw. I told her I was in my home on a Montana mountain serving silver oak wine to our friends. Then she walked me backward through my history, pausing at what seemed to be random increments of my life, to sample what was going on at different ages. "I want you to think of a peaceful time in your childhood," she said. "Picture the house where you lived." I remembered the front yard of our Yeager Street house and my favorite photo, the one when I was 6 years old, standing with my 2 brothers dressed in our Davy Crockett outfits and holding Jungle Jim rifles. I looked at that little boy in the center. He is a good kid. He loves his mama and daddy. He is sweet. He is happy. And he has no idea of what is coming. "Is there anything you would like to say to that little boy?" the therapist asked. I wanted to hold him. "Jackie, everything will be all right," I said. "God will rescue you one day. He'll start a new history with your family. Jesus will gather all of you into his family, and your lives will make a difference for heaven." Then I cried for that little boy. He did not deserve what came next in his life. "Would you put the little boy someplace safe?" asked the therapist. I pictured myself picking up the little boy and sliding him into my heart. "I want to bring your mother in now," said the therapist. Someone opened and shut the door. I kept my eyes closed. I knew Mom was not in the room, but I spoke to her like she was. I said things trapped in my heart since childhood, things I could not say because of Mom's fragility and my denial, things that had frozen my heart with rage. "Mom," I screamed, "why did you beat hell into your kids? Do you have any clue how screwed up we are because of you?" I yelled at Mom for a long time, reminding her of specific sins. Then I calmed down and thanked her for all the good things I could think of. And then I said, "Goodbye, Mom. I love you. I'll see you soon." Then the therapist brought Dad into the room. "Dad," I screamed all over again, "Dad, how could you throw us away like that? Hadn't you ever heard of divorce? Leave Mom, not us. You could have been the greatest father in the world. You could have held my kids in your lap. You killed my hero." On and on I went until I could think of no more bad things to scream at my dad. Then I calmed down and said the good things. "I miss you, Dad," I said. I grew up missing you because I love you. I never stopped loving you. You were the hero I always wanted to be. Good, strong, smart, brave. I wish you had hung around to brag on me. I've spent my life looking for another father. I wished I could have watched you grow old. I don't know what your demons were or why you gave in to them. You were hurt worse than I know. But I believe your hurts are healed now, and I can't wait to see you again. I did not cry at Dad's funeral. I never said goodbye to him. I finally said goodbye to him in that dark room, and I gave up the tears I'd saved since I was 12 years old. The therapist brought in Papa. Mr. Barley, I said, my name is Dr. Jack Deere. I am your grandson, a fact I would not wish on anyone, you heartless, stupid bully, you child beater. Thank you for dying early. You spared all of us years of pain. My only regret is that you did not live long enough for me to pay you back. Now get out. The therapist hesitated and then asked, is it all right if I bring your son Scott in? Yes. I had not written a letter to Scott. The door opened and closed. Before I spoke, I saw a vision of Scott. It was his first grade picture. He was 6 years old. He looked like the six-year-old me in the photo on Yeager Street. He lived all of his short life never liking himself, never seeing the beauty in his life. Scotty, Scotty, how I miss you. You were so much like me in your recklessness. You made me laugh more than anyone. I was mad at you for so long. I'm not mad at you anymore. I was so obsessed with changing your behavior that I was oblivious to your torment. If only you were here now, I would know your pain, Scott. I'd make sure you knew in your heart that I loved you and was proud of you. And then it was over. It seemed like 20 minutes had passed, but the clock on the wall told me 2 hours had flown by. It's a miracle you are still alive, said one woman. I thought you were having a heart attack, said another. I have never seen that much rage in anyone. I went outside and sat on a bench behind a building. A woman wandered by, saw me sitting trance-like, and asked, are you okay? I'm fine, thank you, I said. I returned to gazing at the northernmost reaches of the high Sonoran desert. The hard, tan ground grew scattered evergreen shrubs and evergreen trees, as well as saguaro cactus. White and violet flowers bloomed randomly. The rocky ground rose up and away from me until it turned into low mountains in the distance. The desert was still and bright at noon. The morning doves had retreated to their roost until late afternoon. A lone mountain wren flitted across the sky and landed in the top of a tall pine. The silent landscape was as still as my heart. Then the wren warbled a serenely sweet serenade. A warm breeze blew across my face. High up above in the cloudless blue sky, a red-tailed hawk drifted on the thermals. I felt light enough to float up and drift with him. What I had been told earlier must be true. Anger circulates in our bodies as a negative energy until we discharge it. We can carry it for years, punishing people we love, never understanding why. I sat on the bench for more than an hour, staring into the high desert, discovering more of its wild beauty. Until that moment, I had seen mostly barrenness when I looked at my life. Now I could see my life like the high desert. The barrenness only made the beautiful more beautiful. At last, I surrendered to the truth that I would always live in the high desert, a mixture of the bleak and the beautiful. That photo kept coming back to me. I closed my eyes and stared at that six-year-old boy named Jackie standing in his yard on Christmas Day, dressed in his hero clothes. I like that boy, such a sweet face. It was the first time I remember liking myself. Chapter 47. Lisa spent 3 more weeks at the rehab and then left against the advice of her counselors. They told her she needed 2 more months in their version of a halfway house, or she would drink again. She did. She went to 2 more 28-day rehabs. She loved the rehabs, but she couldn't cope with life outside them. And I settled back into my role as her personal sobriety coach. The sounds in our house mocked my failure. Corks popped, ice cubes tinkled in glasses, and pills rattled against plastic as they flowed into her hand. For the first time in 2 years, I spoke to Scott Manley, my first Christian mentor. It was at the end of August 2008. The circumstances couldn't have been worse. Scott wanted to have his own children more than anything else, but Scott and Ann could not have children, so they adopted a daughter, Monica, and then a son, Guy. But Guy hated his parents. When he grew older, violence, drugs, crime, and jail became regular features of his life. At 34 years old, an overdose left Guy on life support. Scott had just come home from watching the physicians disconnect his only son from the machines. I wept with him on the phone. I told him he was the greatest father I'd ever known. I reminded him that I'd named my second son after him. Soon there was nothing left to say. I vowed to come to Oklahoma City so we could go fishing and drink good wine. "I love you," I said. "I love you, too." I never went fishing with Scott. In September, he went into the hospital with a mysterious flu. By the end of December, doctors diagnosed him with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. His lungs were scarring and thickening. He was suffocating to death. They didn't know the cause. They had no cure. Scott was claustrophobic, and I couldn't imagine a more undeserving death. He remained so kind and cheerful that the nurses fought each other for the right to care for him as he died. Scott's secretary brought her 5-year-old daughter to see Scott. The little girl sat on the bed with him. He could barely talk. Breathing was hard. Scott used some of his last breaths to tell this little one that Jesus loved her very much and always would. Scott assured the little one that Jesus would always take care of her. Scott took his last breath less than 5 months after he buried his son. Life wasn't fair to him. Neither was death. He always gave more than he took. 1,000 people attended Scott's memorial service. The officiating pastor asked anyone whom Scott had impacted to stand. More than 90% of the room rose to their feet. The testimony to his life was silent but eloquent. "The only legacy that lasts is written on the hearts you help bring closer to heaven." Scott did that for all of us. Alcohol continued to consume Lisa's life, as did my efforts to stop her from drinking. On September 28, 2009, I came home from a men's retreat in Colorado to find a note propped up on the kitchen counter. It was from Lisa. "Dear Jack," it began, "I don't want to hurt you. I know this will hurt you." Chapter 48. When I finished reading the note, I wasn't stunned. I was stopped. My mind crashed. Fear paralyzed me. The letter made me out to be a fallen pastor. It accused me of heartless hypocrisy, rage, financial fraud, and sexual sin. According to the letter, Lisa was a battered woman living in terror with a religious sociopath, the man who had wrecked her world and the world of so many others. She had finally found the courage to escape. My life was over. Lepers have more friends than fallen pastors. I would be forced into exile somewhere. Lisa had someone hack into my computer and copy the hard drive with all our financial records, bank account numbers, and passwords. She had someone break into the safe in my closet where I kept all her medication. The pills and cash were gone. The filing cabinet had been emptied of financial and medical records. The Persian rugs were gone. So was the wine from my wine cellar. Lisa's letter said she would sell these things if I cut off her credit cards. She was starting a new life, and she would need money. She listed 5 things that I was not to do. At the top of her list was I was not to try to contact her or find her. If I failed to comply with just one of her demands, she would publish the truth about me, and I would be finished. I slept 4 hours that night. I waited in the darkness while the sun rose. I was on grief time now, where in a minute there are many days. After the sun came up, a single verse of scripture came to mind. "Wait for the Lord, be strong, take heart, and wait for the Lord." Psalm 27, verse 14. The promise that God would come into my disaster helped me endure the torment of waiting. This scary and hopeful promise forced me to make an admission I had avoided. I really was powerless. The next morning, I woke up in the dark again. I grabbed a cup of coffee and fled to my study. I didn't know if I could wait. I considered pressing my Glock pistol to my temple. Then I saw my son Stephen's face. Do I really want to leave him like my father left me? Does ending my pain justify starting his? Do I want to cheat his kids out of a grandfather? I banished the thought of ending my life and prayed and journaled for the rest of the morning. At noon, I called Jim, who was on a cruise in the Aegean Sea. He excused himself from dinner with Susie and their guest. I read the letter to him without edit or comment. He asked some questions about particular accusations. I told him none of the financial charges were true. Some of the other charges were. "This is all bullshit, Jack," he said. "This is private stuff between a man and his wife." And then he cried for me. We both knew I was headed for exile into the outer darkness. "I love you, Jack," Jim said. "I am so glad you're in my life." On Tuesday, 8 days after Lisa left, I fell asleep on the couch in front of the TV. At 10:40, my cell phone rang. "Blocked" appeared on the screen. "Hello?" "Jack?" "Sweetie, don't you call me sweetie. I'm not your sweetie. My name is Lisa. You call me Lisa." My cell log recorded 8 calls between 10:40 p.m. and 12:08 a.m. It was an angry recital of 35 years of my sins against her and others. I agreed with every accusation, but she didn't believe me. Then she hung up and called back for the next round. At 12:08 a.m., she said, "I love you. Can I come to see you right now for just a little while?" "Honey, that's the best offer I've had all evening." 5 minutes later, she was at the front door. She was high, and she had been drinking. She parked at the end of the street, not in our driveway. She came into the house. We kissed, we talked, we cried. We declared our love for each other. She left at 2 a.m., still under the influence. She declined my offer to drive her back. 30 minutes later, the phone rang again. "Are you following me?" "No, never, sweetie." "Then go to the bathroom and flush the toilet so I can hear it." I put my cell phone next to the toilet and flushed. "Thank you. I love you," she said. "I love you, too, with all my heart." At 5 a.m., she called back. "I'm on a freeway out of gas," she said. "What freeway?" "I don't know. 18-wheelers are flying by. I want to jump in front of one." "Honey, stay in the car. Calm down. I'll find you. Can you see an exit sign? Precinct line." "Okay, I know where you are. Do not get out of the car. I'm on my way." 10 minutes later, I sat beside her in the Suburban. Lisa was in panic mode. All hell had broken loose. When the woman who had drawn up the blueprint for Lisa's escape discovered Lisa had come to our home to see me, Lisa said the woman lit into her. She berated Lisa nonstop for an hour, telling Lisa that she had ruined everything. The woman raged that now no one would believe I was an abusive husband. Lisa said, "I'm in trouble. I broke the rules." Her purse lay open on the console of our Suburban. I could see 5 bottles of pills. I asked her to let me drive her to our home. She could sleep for a while and then figure out what she wanted to do. She said no. The AAA driver arrived to work on Lisa's car, and I got out of the Suburban to show him my card. She locked the doors and wouldn't let me back in the car. After the man put the gas in, she drove off into the darkness on a busy freeway, still upset and still under the influence. Back home, I sat in my brown leather chair and wondered if I would ever see Lisa again. Inside my head, conflicting voices abounded. One voice told me I was stupid for letting Lisa drive off drunk into the dark. Another spewed out a series of what-ifs and trapped me in a cavalcade of contingencies. Another said this was all happening because I was a jerk. My counselor said I should probably divorce Lisa. A friend said I should hire an attorney and sue her friends. In the middle of all those voices was a gentle whisper. It told me I wouldn't be judged for what my enemies do, only for what I do. Instead of focusing on getting Lisa back, I focused on that gentle whisper, trusting it to return me to sanity. The war within me abated. Peace returned. About a month later, Lisa's creditors began calling. "This is a very important call for Lisa Deer," said the voice on the recording. "If you are not Lisa Deer, press 2. I pressed 2. "Are you Lisa Deer?" a real voice asked. "Do I sound like Lisa Deer? Besides, I pressed 2. Is there something wrong with your software? Do you know how to get in touch with Lisa Deer? I was about to ask you the same question." "Sir, it is very important that we get in touch with Lisa Deer." "I feel the same way. Good luck." "Sir, this is not funny. I don't like Smart Alex either. We need to reach her within 7 days. "Oh, no. Are you going to cut off her credit cards? Turn her over to a collection agency?" "Sir, we are not at liberty to talk with you about Mrs. Deer." "Can you talk with me about Miss Campbell? That was her maiden name. She may prefer that name now." "Sir, we are not at liberty to talk with you about Mrs. Deer." "She told me not to use that liberty either." I met with a counselor each week. We talked about boundaries, healthy limits on the type of interactions we will allow. Boundaries protect us, keep us from being used, and bring a sense of order to our lives. But like any good thing, they can be misused. At the end of October, I sent Lisa a letter that told her I wanted no communication from her until she had been sober for 6 months. Jim questioned the wisdom of the letter. I told her that she had to be fixed before I would take her back. If God treated me like that, I could never draw near to him. Despite my growing anger, I worried that we might reach a point of no return. So I crossed the boundary I had tried to establish and sent a message to her through one of her friends. "I want to see you," I said. She sent word back that she wanted to see me, too. We met at a mutual friend's house the night before Thanksgiving. I watched her get out of the car. She was fendimetrazine slim. She wore a long-sleeved white blouse and jeans. She looked beautiful and serene like the first time I saw her. She wasn't wearing her wedding ring. She asked to hide her car in our friend's garage. She might get caught seeing me and be in trouble. Her friends had been emphatic from the start, "You can never go back to Jack." They had set up an appointment with a divorce attorney who would work pro bono since Lisa was a battered wife. I was supposed to be served with papers next week. When she heard I wanted to see her, Lisa canceled the appointment with a lawyer. At the meeting, we acknowledged that we loved each other, but Lisa was not ready to come home. A week later, she called. "I think I'm having a nervous breakdown," she said. The woman who had taken charge of Lisa's life would not stop berating her. Stephen was in town for the weekend. She asked that he come get her and her things. Lisa came home. She was high and drunk, but I was grateful to have her back, even if it meant returning to our Sisyphean life. Chapter 49. Karen Blixen, the woman who wrote Out of Africa, was asked by a writer in 1957 to comment on the dismantling of her life in Africa. She said, "All sorrows can be born if you put them into a story or tell a story about them. The people who recover from the wreckage of their trauma are people who can write a new story for their lives where their pain betters them. My story is about love. The boy in the picture with the Davy Crockett outfit and the Jungle Jim rifle was happy because he loved and was loved. Then he learned that love would crush him, and that when you love someone, you put yourself at their mercy. You give them power to hurt you. The boy hated being powerless, so he built walls around himself to keep love out. But love was patient, it was kind, it kept no record of his wrongs, and it kept climbing over those walls. When the boy became a man, love crushed him again and again. The man saw that broken people were the hardest to love because their wounds caused them to lash out in fear. The man learned to diagnose the various ways in which people were broken and tried to fix them. That was safer than trying to understand and love them. Just another barrier he erected. But love is as relentless as rain that hollows out stone. I shut the car door, and Lisa collapsed into tears. We drove home in silence from another hospital stint because of an overdose. I was angry, but I didn't show it. I was angry because she couldn't see the pain she caused those who loved her. "The kids must hate me," she said. "No, they love you. They must think I'm horrible." "No, they're worried about you." In the evening, I cooked dinner, blackened tuna, fresh asparagus, and salad. Then Lisa wanted to color in a child's coloring book. While I began to clean up the kitchen, she slipped into bed and cried some more. She said she was depressed and scared. I continued my role as doctor, pharmacist, caretaker, and parent. I couldn't remember what it was like to be Lisa's husband and friend. An hour later, Lisa got up and went back to coloring and watching TV. I put the last of the dishes away and sat down beside her, a 57-year-old woman searching for some self-esteem in a coloring book, trying to reclaim a stolen childhood. She tried so hard to stay between the lines on the page and didn't notice my staring. At that moment, a barrier I had built crashed down in a deluge of love that I could feel coursing through my body. I loved her as a little girl with her coloring book. I loved her as a young mother who reveled in motherhood and delighted in her three children. And I loved her as a 57-year-old woman who tottered on the abyss of insanity. I never felt so much love for her, and I'd never been able to help her less. A few months later, the young receptionist at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center in Grapevine, our favorite emergency room, studied my insurance card. She looked up and asked, "You're not Jack Deere the author, are you?" "Guilty," I said. "I love your books. I give them away all the time," she said. "Thanks." "What brings you to the emergency room at midnight?" she asked. "The doctors are trying to revive my wife from an alcohol binge and possible pill overdose. We're not sure what she took in addition to the wine." "Oh," she said as she looked down, "I'm sorry." "Me too. Thanks." I filled out the admission forms and went back into the emergency room. Lisa had regained a woozy consciousness. The slender gray-haired doctor held a cup full of thick gray liquid. He explained that it was a charcoal cocktail meant to neutralize any sleeping pills she might have taken. If you don't swallow every bit of this, we will pump your stomach, and that experience will not be nearly as pleasant as drinking the charcoal, the doctor said. Without a word, she threw her head back and gulped down the nasty concoction as though it were a small bottle of Pinot Grigio. That night, I prayed in her room until she fell asleep, because I would rather be terrified beside Lisa's ICU bed than be happy in a mansion with someone else. When I wasn't rescuing Lisa from her binges or playing golf with friends, I stood on a stage and told people that God loves us, even though we are pretty screwed up. I told them that sometimes at my worst moments, God overpowers me with his affection. Almost nothing in my life has worked out like I thought it should. I thought as I grew older, I would grow more deserving of God's love, not less. While Lisa bounced from binge to binge, I lived from failure to failure. A young executive from Cincinnati visited my church. "I love your book," she said. "I listen to your sermons online all the time." I invited her to come to lunch with a few of my friends after the service. "That would be wonderful," she said. Then she hesitated for just a second and said, "I thought there would be thousands of people here." "Me too," I said. I sent a draft of a book I had worked on for 5 years to a successful author friend. She returned it with handwritten criticisms. The space between her criticisms increased. Then they stopped altogether. She was too polite to tell me that my book was not salvageable. I couldn't write. I couldn't build a church. I couldn't get my wife sober. So every morning I sat in my brown leather overstuffed chair in the center of my study. And for the first time in my life, I prayed more than I studied. I asked God to search my heart and expose the offensive things. I asked him to grant me grace to gaze on his beauty. I saw, too, that I was a broken person who lashed out in fear. Gabor Mate wrote, "People jeopardize their lives for the sake of making the moment livable." Somewhere I heard that telling a person who has been trapped in an addiction for years to stop is like filling up a person with laxatives and then telling them not to poop. I had tried to save Lisa by laying down laws, taking away things, and threatening her. When my affection dried up, she turned to the warmth of dopamine hugs and serotonin kisses given to her by alcohol and opioids. When I told people what I had endured, they pitied me. But she was the true sufferer. She grew up abused, abandoned, and shamed. The childhood stress helped to hardwire her for addiction. But she couldn't remember a time when she did not love God. She did not drink when we married. I brought wine into our home. For thousands of days, I prayed for Lisa's sobriety. I prayed for my church to grow. I prayed to be able to write. God said no, again and again. Then the lecturer ran out of lectures. I was powerless not only over alcohol, but over life as well. My efforts to sober up Lisa made her suffering worse. Yet she was still standing, not tall, not straight, but standing. Anyone else would have fallen long ago. Each day, a drinking alcoholic who no longer saw beauty in herself became more beautiful to me. In mid-November 2011, I sat on the couch with the Wall Street Journal. Our home had been tranquil for almost 3 weeks, but Lisa had not come out of the bedroom that morning. If we stayed true to our routine, another binge loomed. Lisa knew she wasn't safe, and she agreed with the one restriction I put on her, that she couldn't drive. She didn't want to be responsible for harming another family. At 11 o'clock, she still had not come out of the bedroom. I accepted the fact that apart from divine intervention, one day she wouldn't come out of the bedroom. Accepted meant I had renounced coercion, manipulation, and lies as a means of changing her. Accepted meant I prayed for Lisa and enjoyed her today while I could. Half an hour later, Lisa still hadn't emerged from the bedroom. I thought maybe I should check on her. She had gone to bed sober last night, but that didn't mean she would wake up sober. I didn't want to open our bedroom door. Every time I put my right hand on the doorknob, fear pricks my heart. It has been 9 years and 11 months since the morning I opened the door to Scott's bedroom. The thought of opening our bedroom door releases an album of pictures in my brain. I put the newspaper down. I swallowed. I sighed. I stood. Lisa walked in wearing a blue blouse and jeans. She looked serious. She had a pill bottle in her right hand. "Jack, I want to stop drinking now. I want you to give me Antabuse every morning," she said. And then she handed me a bottle of Antabuse. Antabuse, disulfiram, blocks the liver's ability to metabolize alcohol. So the person who drinks alcohol after taking Antabuse skips the euphoria stage and goes straight to the hangover. But it's not a normal hangover. It's a hangover times 10 to the 10th power. A couple of years ago, Lisa drank while she was on Antabuse. Her head exploded. She thought she was having a stroke. She threw up until the dry heaves racked her abdomen, and she felt her stomach crawling up her esophagus. She never drank again on Antabuse. But after a few weeks of not drinking, she refused to take Antabuse. That morning, she wanted to try Antabuse again. Hope rose in me. The Antabuse was her idea. I hadn't suggested it. I no longer suggested anything. Each morning after that, I ground up the Antabuse tablet and stirred the powder into half a glass of water, and Lisa gulped it down. I ground up the tablet and dissolved it in the water so Lisa couldn't hide the tablet under her tongue and spit it out after I left the room. After she downed her morning sobriety drink, she drank coffee and hung out with me for about 30 minutes. So she had no opportunity to secretly throw up the medicine. On the rare mornings when I forgot her medicine, she would bring it to me. After a while, Lisa became interested in things. She started different art projects. She hung out with friends. Our social life was resurrected. Lisa brought the children of our young friends over to color, draw, paint, or make cards for hours at a time. Some evenings I heard Lisa and her friends laughing upstairs in Lisa's art room. Laughter. I didn't realize how much I miss Lisa's laughter. Her laughter is pure. She is too honest for courtesy laughter. Some weekends, she and her friend Debbie and one or two others checked into a hotel in the middle of our outdoor mall for a girls' weekend slumber party. Weeks without a drink turned into months and then a year. Chapter 50. On April 9, 2011, I performed the wedding ceremony for Stephen and his bride, Lindsay. A year later, Rachel Marie Deer entered my world. She had brown hair, fair skin, and blue eyes. I wanted my first grandchild to be a son. I was so stupid. I had no idea of the perfect little beauty God waited to give me. Give me? I sound like a father now. I'm only a grandfather. But I don't feel like a grandfather. How is a grandfather supposed to feel? I didn't know it would feel this good. Yes, I had three babies of my own. I marveled at them. I loved them. But I had them too soon. I was too preoccupied with building my kingdom. I didn't enjoy them as much as I could have. I have more time than I've ever had, but I'm not retired. I'm focused on enjoying the ones I love and the one I love. And that counts for more than what I'm building. On Memorial Day 2012, I listened to my son read Rachel a bedtime story. This was their nightly routine. She was 2 months old during this bedtime story. Lindsay held Rachel and leaned into Stephen. I sat beside the family of three on their worn, velvety, chocolate-brown couch. Lisa stretched out on the floor of their loft in downtown St. Louis. Stephen opened the book so Rachel could see the pictures. He read the words using different accents. He had to fight off his own laughter. Lindsay laughed, too. Rachel giggled and touched the pictures. I looked at Lisa stretched out on the floor, basking in the love of her son for his wife and baby girl. At last, her world was sober, right, and happy. I stared at Lisa and saw another baby girl who never enjoyed a scene like this. A baby girl to whom a single book was never read, who was left alone with caretakers, who was used as a sexual object by her father, and who went undefended by her mother, who became jealous of her. "I hate you," the little girl's mother once said to her. "You make me want to kill myself." Then I remembered that little girl at 22, as she held her infant son, Stephen, and sang to him and prayed over him. She was enraptured with love for her baby boy, confident that at last she walked in the purposes for which she had been created, and thankful to the God who created her, thankful to God who made her what she always and only ever wanted to be, a wife and a mother. I saw that young mother read stories to her infant son, stories that were never read to her, not out of obligation, but because it made her happy to read to her baby boy. I recall Stephen pulling her long brown hair and rubbing the pages of the books. Stephen learned to talk a little, and I saw Lisa read to him all the Beatrix Potter books. A little later, when he could follow bigger stories, Lisa read Charlotte's Web to him. It was the first time for both of them, and they cried together over Charlotte's death at the end. While I built my kingdom, Lisa built a home in Stephen's heart for God. Now Rachel will grow up loved, delighted in, feeling beautiful and smart, with her dignity and defenses intact. As I watched the scene unfold, I was filled with awe at my wife. She could have turned bitter. Instead, she had chosen love. The curse under which she was born had been shattered. In East of Eden, John Steinbeck wrote that we all have one story, and it is the same story, the contest of good and evil within us. Any honest person knows that they are losing this contest. As a child, I could lie to others, but I hadn't yet developed the sophistication to lie to myself. I knew my bad deeds would always push down the scale, so I chose to enjoy my darkness rather than feel guilty about it. Then I discovered that Christ had already borne the weight of my sin, and that once I accepted his gift, he would never leave. Yet St. Peter's scales lingered. In church, I was told, as a Christian, my good deeds would eventually outweigh the bad. Then I preached versions of that same message. But the evidence always contradicted the promise. My life stayed messy. I never stopped needing God's mercy. I once took the biggest piece of pie without a twinge of guilt. After I became a Christian, I never did that again. I manipulated people into giving me the biggest piece of pie, and I thought myself clever. I didn't become a better Christian, only a Christian more sophisticated in his evil. I'm not the first to make this confession. It's in the biographies of many great believers in both Scripture and later history. The purest people claim to be riddled with impurity. The humblest saints claim to be ruled by monstrous pride. At the end of his life, the Apostle Paul claimed that he was the chief of sinners. 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15. He didn't write, "I was the chief of sinners," but "I am the chief of sinners." The closer Paul drew to the light of the world, the more evil he saw in his life. I am no great believer. I wish I could make Paul's confession. Maybe one day I will. But I can confess with Paul, "In my flesh dwelleth no good thing," Romans 7:18. I am more aware of the enormity of evil in me than I've ever been. This is one way I can tell that the light within me is expanding. One truly good person was born into this world. This is the truth. If it were the only truth, then Albert Camus would have been right. Suicide is a legitimate consideration. But there is another great truth. I no longer call you servants. Instead, I have called you friends. John 15:15. Jesus told his disciples on the eve of his crucifixion. He said this over a meal. The only good and holy person wants to be our friend despite our messiness and all our failed attempts to clean ourselves up. The harmony of these two truths is the seed from which obedience flourishes. My first memory is of Dad carrying me through the basement of a department store. His arms never rested to put me down. By the cash register lay a pocket knife. It looked just like the one he carried. I begged him for it and cried when he handed me the rubber imitation. Dad could have told me that a 2-year-old lacks the fine motor skills to carry a knife, and that giving me a blade would only have produced blood. But I would not have understood. For years, I have besieged heaven with thousands of prayers that seemed to go unanswered. Still, I return to that brown leather chair. It is old and worn like me, but I lean back and let it hold me. As I close my eyes, I can sometimes sense the Spirit of God hovering. When I lusted after material wealth, he turned my gaze toward eternity. When I sought large crowds, he brought me humility. When I tried to change my wife, he taught me how to love and understand her. What I needed all along more than anything was to see myself through his eyes. Now I have more days like this one. It is Saturday, June 11th, 2012. The flicker of dawn creeps into my study. I want to see God's beauty. But I'm also trying to find something to say. My Sunday stage waits for me. As usual, my motives are mixed. I open my Bible to Psalm 27:4. One thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. These six lines are the essence of all of King David's Psalms. So on this morning, I tell God I want to gaze on his beauty. But I'm not sure how to go about it. I'm not sure I know how to define his beauty. Artists and poets, theologians and philosophers have argued over beauty for thousands of years. Aquinas's definition of beauty is one of the most famous. Beauty is what gives us pleasure when seen. But that definition is too tame for me. I survey some of Aquinas's modern disciples and cobble together this definition. Beauty is a mysterious harmony that dazzles us. It's not one feature of the Mona Lisa that makes her beautiful. It is the harmony of all of her features. Change one of the features and the magic diminishes. My first sunset over the Pacific Ocean dazzled me. My first hearing of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony dazzled me. Lisa dazzled me when she climbed out of that yellow Pontiac coupe. But after a couple of hours, I am not dazzled. I have searched in all the usual places, Bibles, lexicons, concordances, and commentaries. But this morning, God has not hidden his beauty in books. I walk out of my study and lie down on the guest bed. I vow to stay prostrate until God dazzles me. Maybe my persistence will impress him. For more than an hour, I rummage through my history with God. I recall acts of his mercy, goodness, and forgiveness. But I am left undazzled. My smartphone pings with an email. I pull the phone out of my pocket. There is a video. I forget my vow. I walk back to my computer in my study, and I sit down in my big brown leather chair. The video is 18 seconds long. I watch it over and over. Every time I push play, I think, this is the last time I will watch the video. I need to get back to God. Then I push play again. On the screen, Rachel lies on her back and giggles. Lindsay and Lindsay's mother, Melanie, are both off camera saying, "Say goo, Rachel, say goo." Rachel wiggles about and lifts her hands high in the air. She smiles and says, "Goo," her first syllable at 2 months old. It is one moment among millions that will make up her existence, and yet I want to remain in this moment for as long as possible. A pang of sadness surfaces. She is growing up so fast, and I will miss so much of her life if we stay in separate cities. I want to jump on a plane. I keep watching and watching. I laugh at myself. In my laughter is the gentle whisper, "This is how I feel about you," it says. I shake. I reach for the keyboard. Before I touch the keys, my chest heaves with joy. He has taken an angry 10-year-old boy, surrounded by presents on Christmas morning, and turned him into an old man, awash in gratitude for a child's gibberish. When at last I can speak, I say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." Dear listener, the acknowledgments are coming next. Do not skip them. There is a minimal amount of coarse language in my book. None of it is gratuitous. I am grateful that Zondervan felt as I do, that to tell my story any other way would have been to diminish its authenticity and power. Only three names have been changed in this story: Charlotte, Alex, and Mary. John Sloan, Zondervan's specialist in editing memoirs, was helpful in showing me the architecture of a memoir and keeping my story on track. Ryan Pasdur, the editor who supervised the work from beginning to end, has been a great believer in my story and extraordinarily patient with many last-minute changes. Dirk Bersma brought more than 30 years of experience in copy editing to polish the final version of my memoir. I am grateful to Stan Gundry, senior vice president at Zondervan, who pursued me over the years even though I hadn't published anything in more than a decade. My friends Christopher Abe and Winston Calvert read every line of the book, made many valuable suggestions, and corrected faults that I could not see. I will always be grateful for the love of our close friends who took care of our family when we could not take care of ourselves. Of those wonderful people, John and Nancy Snyder stand out. There has not been any time limit or geographical limit to their love for us. Nancy is with the Lord now. Mark and Nancy Doherty gave Scott a home when we couldn't. We are even closer today. We count each other as family. Mark and Nancy suffered through this manuscript in its verbose earlier stages. I had written 10 pages on what it was like to be in an Old Testament doctoral program. Nancy wrote in the margin of those pages, "Why do I care about this?" Those 10 egotistical, self-indulgent pages have been condensed into 2 sentences that are still not entirely free of egotism. One of the pains in writing this book is that some of my best sentences lie on the cutting floor because the story took a turn that wouldn't permit them. One of the best friends I've ever had lies on the cutting floor as well. Dudley Hall and I have traveled around the world together, speaking at conferences and churches. We have hunted all over our country together. After we lost Scott, we left Montana and moved into a house in Fort Worth, 5 minutes from Dudley. For months, he called and came by every day looking for ways to help us. My son, Stephen Deere, is an award-winning journalist. He has been my best critic and editor. He has shown me features of my story that I could never have seen on my own. More than anyone else, he has made this a better book than I could have ever written by myself. Then there is Lisa, who has been my partner for most of my story. She has endured more trauma than anyone I know, and yet she still loves God and people. Instead of hiding the abuse of her childhood and her adult struggle with alcoholism, she has stood on a stage and told her story to other women who have wept and been freed from the prison of their secrets. She has read every unflattering line I have written about her in this book, with the hope that her story will help others find the freedom that she now lives in. Next to God, she is the hero of my story. For years, I refused to speak publicly about my son's death. I did not want to be like a preacher in a John Updike novel who forges God's name on every sentence he speaks. In those years, I was also learning that when the worst day of your life comes, it is only the beginning of bad. Suddenly it seemed like everybody had a better story than mine. Then my story got worse. God took away just about everything I used to fuel my self-esteem until there was nothing left except his love. And for the first time, I felt his love apart from anything I could offer him. And then I no longer needed a better story.
You've been listening to the audio production of Even in Our Darkness. Text copyright 2018 by Jack Deere. Production copyright 2018 by Zondervan. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other books and audio products from Zondervan, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at zondervan.com. Even in Our Darkness was recorded at Kingswood Productions in Nashville, Tennessee.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.